I'm Duncan Strauss. Really delighted to be bringing you another edition of Talking Animals. A rare edition that's recorded, not live, in which we'll speak with Paige Ulrey, a Seattle attorney and dog handler, who helped launch the use of dogs in courtrooms to help children and others testify in certain cases. An approach that's been embraced in many parts of the country. First, though, as always, we're kicking off the show with an animal tune. This is Nico Case with Maybe Sparrow here on Talking Animals.
Maybe Sparrow, you should wait. The hawks alight till morning. You never pass beyond the gate if you don't hear my warning. Nelson hung so effortless with the rise and fall of Sparrow's breast. It's a drowning dive and back to the chorus. La-dee-da-dee-da-dee-down. La-dee-da-dee-da-dee-down. Moonlight glanced off metal wings in a thunderstorm above the clouds. The engine hums, the sparrows praise. Those who cannot hear the words, those who cannot hear the words, those who will not hear the words. La-dee-da-dee-da-dee-da.
That's Nico Case with Maybe Sparrow, an animal song. Teases into today's edition of Talking Animals. My name's Duncan Strauss. Everybody's trying to get in on the act. Anyway, Nico Case, Maybe Sparrows. Launching us into this edition of Talking Animals. My name's Duncan Strauss, here with our program that is devoted to all subjects in the animal kingdom. In just a few minutes, we'll be hearing from today's guest, Paige Ulrey, Seattle lawyer, senior deputy prosecuting attorney, to be precise, and dog handler, who helped pioneer the use of dogs in courtrooms to make children and others more comfortable when testifying about sexual assaults and other emotionally upsetting crimes. We'll discuss various aspects of courthouse dogs, including some legal challenges that have been raised about their use, when we speak with Paige Ulrey in a few moments here on Talking Animals. And as usual, we'll also welcome your, well, we can't really welcome your questions and comments today. I want to remind you that this is a Memorex version of Talking Animals, one of those rare ones. Either way, a little bit later in the show, we'll step into the comedy corner, which involves animal comedy. We'll play Name That Animal Tune. Could still do that with a little twist. The winner will appear a pair of tickets to see Damien Jr. Gong Marley, November 17th. That'd be tomorrow, Thursday, November 17th at Janus Live. And, of course, we'll hear another animal song or two. Right now, though, it's time for the Animal News and Announcement segment, a look at items of interest in animal news, those things happening locally on the horizon, produced, as always, by the Talking Animals award-winning Rip and Read News Department. Our first item harks back to the that whole awful episode in Zanesville, Ohio, and debt-ridden man distraught over marital problems and deep in debt told one of his farmhands the night before he released a menagerie of African lions, Bengal tigers, and other exotic animals that he had a plan and said to the caretaker, "You will know when it happens." Terry Thompson threw himself, threw open the animals' cages late in the afternoon on October 18th and then committed suicide on his farm near Zanesville in eastern Ohio. According to reports released Friday, sheriff's deputies who arrived at Thompson's private compound had no choice but to shoot the animals crouching between abandoned vehicles and tigers still coming out of their cages. When it was over, 48 animals were dead. Nearly all the cages were unlocked and holes had been cut in the metal fencing. A tiger and a black bear were in the same enclosure, but the door was unlocked and open. As I backed the team up, the tiger came out the door and charged right at us, the deputy Jay Lawhorn. Deputy shot the tiger and the bear after it ran at other officers. Another deputy said he shot a charging black bear that dropped within 7 feet of him. The reports released by the Muskingum County Sheriff's Office reveal how deputies suddenly found themselves in the middle of a desperate hunt. They also offer clues to Thompson's motive. The 62-year-old told the farmhand that he was upset about his marital problems and that he had a plan, according to a deputy who talked with the caretaker. Thompson then told the caretaker, "You will know when it happens." He and his wife had devoted their lives to the animals. He bought his first exotic animal, a lion cub named Simba, at an auction for his wife's birthday about 14 years ago. Just days before he set the animals free, he told a deputy that he was having a tough time taking care of the animals after spending a year in prison on a gun conviction. He was also deep in debt to the Internal Revenue Service. The accounts from deputies at the scene showed just how close the animals came to attacking some of them. Authorities have defended their decision to shoot and kill the animals, saying they were trying to protect the public. Deputies said they saw Thompson's body but couldn't get near him to determine whether he was alive because a white tiger, quote, appeared to be eating the body, a report said. Authorities have said that it appeared one of the big cats dragged his body and that there was a bite mark on his head. Other animals near his body started moving toward a pickup truck where in the back four sheriff's deputies armed with rifles began firing. And as that isn't awful enough in so many ways, there's this follow-up. Five people have been charged with attempting to steal the carcass of a dead lion, one of the herd of exotic animals killed in Ohio last month. WOIO 19 News said Monday that the attempted theft occurred shortly after 61-year-old Terry Thompson set more than 50 of his wild animals, including bears, lions, and tigers, loose and then committed suicide. Police were forced to shoot and kill the animals. The five suspects, ranging in age from 17 to 21, were caught loading the lion's remains into their Jeep, authorities said. It isn't clear exactly what the thieves wanted with the lion carcass, police said. Sheriff Matt Lutz said his office has received several calls from people that would like to take these animals to taxidermists, Fox News reported. Only a half dozen of the wild beasts survived. They were moved to Columbus Zoo, which is now fighting with Thompson's widow to keep the creatures. A police report released Friday revealed that deputies arrived at the Zanesville Animal Preserve on October 18th to find the exotic beast running wild, etc. Ugh. Hard to imagine this story could get tougher, yet here it is. California's law banning the slaughter of animals that can't walk, enacted in 2008 after a gruesome undercover video showed lame cows being waterboarded and jabbed with forklifts at a meat plant in San Bernardino County, was to come before the Supreme Court last week. The laws ban the sale, receipt, or slaughter of any downed livestock and requires them to be immediately euthanized. It also prohibits dragging animals or pushing them with heavy equipment, requiring that they be moved on a sling or a sled. The law has not taken effect because the National Meat Association, based in Oakland, won an injunction in 2009. Meatpackers and the Obama administration contend that California has no right to enforce humane treatment of farm animals. In this case, pigs. Because the federal government has sole authority over slaughterhouses and protects animals under a law Congress passed in 1958. Quote, this is a case of great consequence for states and their authority to take aggressive action to stop animal cruelty, said Wayne Pacelli, president of the Humane Society of the United States. Congress is in the grip of agribusiness lobby, and if we have to wait until Congress acts, we'll be waiting for a very long time to bring relief to these animals and to secure the food supply for the health and well-being of consumers. I remember the Humane Society filmed a video at the Westland Hallmark plant in Chino, causing a national uproar and investigation that led to the recall of 143 million pounds of beef, the largest in U.S. history, and convictions of two workers for animal cruelty. Mentioned this on last week's show. Want to mention it again. Mark your calendar accordingly. And that's the for the Fund for All Ball. That's the benefit for Big Cat Rescue, taking place Sunday, December 11th at Skipper Smokehouse. Doors open at 3 p.m. The first band goes on at 4. There'll be raffles and live painting and fun for all. You get me? Band lineup includes Sunset Bridge, The Human Condition, Skull and Band Bone, and others. And fun evening and a good way to help Big Cat Rescue. Sometimes if you kind of scan far and wide enough here, it's striking what you run into. This is Dateline, Carson City, Nevada. Animal advocates and trappers are at odds over a plan to restrict trapping of fur-bearing animals in Clark and Washoe counties. Special Committee of State Wildlife Commissioners will hold meetings Monday in Las Vegas and Wednesday in Reno on the plan to ban trapping within 10,000 feet of a residence using anything but box or cage traps that don't require animals or pets. The Nevada Humane Society and citizens group TrailSafe say dogs and cats have become entangled and injured in leg traps in Nevada's two most populous counties, and restrictions are needed to protect pets and children. The two groups want to prohibit trapping within at least 3,000 feet of a residence, except for box-style traps that don't injure animals. The Nevada Trappers Association supports such a ban only within 1,000 feet of a residence. Reno-based TrailSafe's website features sad stories of pet owners across the state whose dogs and cats have become caught and injured in leg hold traps. Quote, trapping is an archaic practice. It befuddles me as to how anybody could set a trap for any reason, let alone to use close proximity to domestic animals and kids, said Deborah Drum of Sparks, a business owner who has two cats. So we'll track that one for you as well, of course. And I think that, for the moment at least, we'll do it for our animal news and announcements. Let's step now into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner, which, as always, involves animal comedy. This is Ellen DeGeneres with a piece from a long-ago album called Cat in Heat on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
I personally, I like cats more than dogs. How many people by round of applause like cats more than dogs? Me too. How many people like dogs more than cats? Me too. I have a cat that is in heat right now. You ever had a cat in heat? They just change on you. She was my kitten, my adorable little pet that now is a hooker. She's wearing makeup. I went into the bathroom the other night. She's putting on mascara. Tonight, won't be just any. La la. Mm-hmm. She didn't know the whole song. Mm-hmm. She just knew some of the words. Mm-hmm. She's an indoor cat, but male cats know she's in there somehow. They're just all around the house, and somehow she's sneaking out because the other morning I found a stamp on her paw. Yeah. I wouldn't have noticed. I just bought this new black light, and she passed right under it. Oh, hey! What is that? So these male cats, they are sneaky. They're trying to get in for... They're just... The other day, one of them disguised himself as a UPS man. Yeah, the truck, the packages, everything. I said, I'm not falling for that. You know, the suit was just hanging off of him. Just... little name tag said Fluffy. Oh, right. I will not sign here. Scoot. Driving off all mad in that big truck. Stripping the gears. They don't know how to drive. Cats. Came back the next day as a cable repairman. Same outfit. Little butt crack hanging out this time. That's... so he fooled me. I let him in. I caught on. But he got Nickelodeon for free. He hooked that up somehow. So get to see all the old shows. Boy, when cats mate, they just mate. They don't care where they are, what time it is, how loud they are, who they're with. Wouldn't that be great? That is... but then you compare it to, like, I was watching the Discovery Channel, and penguins are monogamous for life. Penguins mate for life. Which doesn't really surprise me that much. They all look exactly alike. It's not like they're going to meet a better-looking penguin someday. Even if they are cheating, how do you know? I think that's me he's with. Sandra, doesn't that look like me?
All right. That was Ellen DeGeneres with a piece called Cat in Heat, taken from her 1996 CD, Taste This. I'm Duncan Strauss. This is Talking Animals. Our website is talkinganimals.net. Nearly time to hear from today's guest, Paige Ulrey. As I touched on earlier, Paige is a Seattle lawyer, senior deputy prosecuting attorney in King County, and a dog handler and dog lover who helped pioneer the use of dogs in courtrooms to make children and others more comfortable on the stand when testifying about sexual assault and other emotionally upsetting crimes. An approach that's been embraced in many parts of the country, while there have been some legal challenges raised about their use. So in an interview recorded last Wednesday, this is Paige Ulrey on Talking Animals. All right, let's welcome to Talking Animals, Paige Ulrey. Thanks so much for joining us on Talking Animals, Paige.
Thank you for having me, Duncan.
And so in the last few years, the use of courtroom dogs has you know, really expanded nationally, it seems, but it really all began in your office with a colleague of yours. Maybe you could sort of walk us through those beginnings.
Sure. It was about 8 years ago, and I at the time was just innocently wanting to get a dog. And a friend of mine and colleague, Ellen O'Neill Stevens, at that point had a dog from an agency called Canine Companions for Independence, which is an agency that raises, trains, and places dogs with people with disabilities, but also dogs in facilities to work with people who have some kind of physical impairments who need the assistance in some way of a service dog. So Ellen suggested that our office apply for a dog from CCI, this agency, to work with victims of crime to help them through difficult interviews and through the whole court process, which can be so traumatizing for people who are already somewhat traumatized.
Sure.
So based on her suggestion, we talked to the office, and after kind of taking a little bit to get its head around this novel idea, the office agreed. And then we applied to CCI to get a service dog or a facility dog. And initially they denied our application, and then we reapplied and kind of realized a little bit better how we should frame the application and how what would appeal to them as far as placing one of these dogs with us. And then at that point...
Yeah, Paige, sorry, if I could. I'm just curious, like, why the initial denying of your application, therefore having to sort of reframe when you reapplied. What did they cite a specific reason or a set of reasons? Or?
Yeah, you know, they spend about $60,000 on each one of their dogs. So the dogs are just incredibly well-trained and just these beautiful creatures who are in their minds, really – designed or trained to work with people with significant disabilities or real needs that will take advantage of the many commands that these dogs know and their impeccable behavior. So I think their fear was that the dogs would be underutilized in this role and that really they would be a quasi-therapy dog, which doesn't require the same degree of skills that a service dog or a facility dog requires.
So it's like, hey, we're not going to squander all this high-caliber training on this particular use. That's
exactly.
Kind of what, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So then you reapplied and obviously success.
Exactly. So then they called me, and this was about 7 years ago, and said, you know, we're accepting your application and can you come down to California in a couple of weeks to our training facility to be trained to get a dog. So I went down with a colleague of mine at the time who was our office's child interviewer. And we flew down to California 2 weeks later and spent about 5 days or 6 days in their training facility, basically learning how to work with these incredibly well-skilled dogs.
Mm-hmm. And so when did you first meet Ellie?
So we had this training, and you get there, and everyone's very excited. People in the training were all working at different facilities. One woman worked with children on a cancer ward of a hospital. Another person worked in a rehab facility. Another person worked in a kindergarten teacher who worked with developmentally disabled children. And so we all were there with very specific needs and also very excited about getting these dogs. It was sort of like adopting a child to us.
Yeah.
And so we got there and it was sort of the introduction to our training. They brought out these dogs all freshly bathed and just these beautiful dogs, and they had six dogs there for five different facility teams to choose from. And so I saw Ellie right away, and she was she has this kind of darker, she's a yellow lab, but she's got this sort of dark little rings around her eyes. She looks very serious, and I saw her right away and just immediately thought she was cool and that she would be a great dog for us to work with. She just seemed right to me. And then we started working with them over the next 3 days. And so they had us work with each of the different dogs to see how you worked with them and what your, you know, chemistry was with the dog and how the dog behaved with you to see if that dog would be the right fit for your facility.
Sure.
So I worked with Ellie on the third day for half a day, and she really didn't respond to any of the commands that I just learned, and kind of was quite stubborn, I thought, and really very frustrating to work with. And I just knew there was no chemistry between Ellie and me, and there was no way that I was going to be getting Ellie as a placement.
Yeah.
And at the end of that third day, they asked us to rank which dogs we wanted in the order of, you know, from first to last.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember very clearly on that day, I just wrote any dog but Ellie would be fine. So I, you know, it just was clear to me that was not a good fit.
Right.
So they then met for several hours, and the next morning they brought the dogs out one by one and handed them to each of the different teams for placement. And one by one they brought out all the dogs that I loved and thought I was going to get, until they brought out Ellie, and then they brought her over to me, and I was incredibly surprised. Of course, it was just I was certain that wasn't going to happen.
Yeah.
So I was a little bit apprehensive and frankly a little bit disappointed. And,
did you not read my rankings? I said anyone but Ellie. Yeah.
I thought this was my choice.
Right.
So they basically said to me, you know, Paige, Ellie is a pretty sturdy little character, and she's very composed and possessed, and she's just that she has got the perfect sort of emotional makeup for the high degree of drama and emotion and kind of turmoil it's going to deal with in your office. And we think she's a good fit for you. And they said that, and I said, okay, all right. And you know, of course, I immediately started falling in love with her after that. And you know, once she was mine, I realized all the great things about her. And what really happened was that I started to bond with her. And mm-hmm. as soon as we started to bond, she started to respond to my commands and to listen much more to what I told her to do. So that whole stubbornness really reduced itself quite a bit, and she became much more responsive and willing to work with me.
Well, it also sounds a little bit like kind of your classic, you know, romance in, you know, literature, film, whatever. It's the people, of course, do not get along at first, who then have blossom into this fantastic, you know, relationship, and you know, live semi-happily ever after. But so once you're paired up and you guys are then starting to click and think, oh my God, okay, she is the right one for me. Still, were there some unusual challenges of the training for you or for Ellie? I mean, you know, again, this was sort of a new purpose, so you're not necessarily following a game plan that's been designed the way that probably everyone else that you were at that facility, you know, with did have.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, one of the different things about our work was going to be that I was going to be handing her off to other people, because I can't sit in on all of the defense interviews with victims, nor could our child interviewer do that. It just wasn't practical. So. Mm-hmm. I think for one of the first times, they were actually agreeing to allow a dog be, you know, to be in a room with a victim and with a prosecutor in there, without the handler being in there with the dog. And that was a difficult transition for us to figure out. And I kind of over time have developed ways of handling that, and I've done some trainings for prosecutors and staff in our office on how to work with Ellie. Mm. And I think we've really figured out a good way of doing that in the office.
And I'm guessing this is largely rhetorical, but because this was sort of became your sort of project and undertaking, were you always a dog person? I mean, did you grow up with dogs or other animals, or?
I have always been a dog person.
Yeah.
We lived on a farm starting from when I was in about fifth grade, and we had dogs then, like, from almost the beginning of living there and throughout the rest of my school years. And then when I went to college, I actually, my senior year of college was living off campus, and I got a dog then. And I've really had dogs whenever I could in my life. I just completely love being with them, and I think they make my life just so much richer.
Sure. So you were kind of the, at least in that office, probably the natural person to sort of unhatch this experiment.
I think so.
Yeah. So this is Talking Animals. In a conversation recorded last week, I'm speaking with Paige Ulrey, Senior Deputy Prosecuting Attorney in Seattle's King County, who works with and lives with a courthouse dog named Ellie. So Paige, what's the temperament that's needed for a courthouse dog? I mean, now this was some years ago, the training you were describing. So, and obviously Ellie has worked out fabulously well, but so what have you learned, about Ellie and maybe other courthouse dogs that you've since come into contact with? What is really crucial for their temperament, given the kind of singular demands of this kind of work?
Well, you know, the quality that they sort of articulated to me when I got her at the training has been to me probably has become the most important quality for one of these dogs to have. And that is this kind of this self-sufficiency and this sturdiness of character. A lot of dogs in these programs can, or any dog really, can be pretty needy and dependent on a person emotionally for reassurance and just sort of constant affirmation of their behavior. And I don't think that's so good for a dog in this situation. The dog really has to be able to be passed off from one person to another,
mm-hmm.
Be in a situation where there might be a lot of turmoil, both as far as the environment is concerned, but also as far as the degree of emotion that's going on is concerned.
Yeah.
And the dog has to be able to withstand that and kind of be okay with that and be able to stay calm and impeccably well-behaved in the worst of circumstances.
Yeah.
And Ellie really has that quality, and it's served both of us very well in the last 7 years.
Sure. Well, so... maybe to just kind of expand on that, maybe you could give us kind of a specific sense of how she works and the difference she can make in a case, either by, you know, describing one or more cases that she was sort of pivotal to helping out with that you were involved with.
Sure. I actually had a case involving the death of a developmentally disabled man in a group home situation. And the main witness in that case was another resident of this home who was also developmentally disabled. And she had seen her friend lying on the ground and basically dying in front of this caregiver who we ultimately charged with neglect.
Mm.
And so she had to go through a deposition before trial and then testify at trial, and also wanted to come to the sentencing of this case because it was very important to her. But she was very anxious about this trial, obviously, and had never been through anything like that before. And so I asked her when I went out to meet her for the first time if she liked dogs, and she just lit up when I asked her that. And I told her about Ellie, and I asked her if she'd like to have Ellie with her during this case, and she said she would love that. And so during the deposition, Ellie sat with her at her feet, and I gave her Ellie's leash, you know, and I just said, you know, you need to just take care of Ellie during this deposition and make sure she's okay, and make sure nobody steps on her tail or her paws. And she loved having that responsibility, and I think it gave her a sense of control in a situation where she really had no control at all.
Hmm.
And helped her throughout the process.
Yeah.
She sat with Ellie during the trial, and also when she came back for sentencing, she was with Ellie then too. And so all of that made the whole experience, I think, a much more positive one for her.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that since then, she calls me periodically and asks me to bring Ellie out to see her. So we go see her probably every 6 months or so, and she just continues to have this love for Ellie and want to have Ellie in her life.
Wow. And so would you say that that's kind of a fairly quintessential scenario with using Ellie in a case? I mean, I know in this case it's a developmentally disabled adult as opposed to a kid, but I mean, are there some really distinct differences when a child that's having to testify in a you know, emotionally and difficult case? I mean, are they largely, you know, sort of similar things that Ellie brings to those scenarios?
I think she brings fairly similar things. I think an adult might have, especially a developmentally disabled adult, might have sort of a stronger sense of a need for respect, perhaps from the people in the system who they're there with, and so I think Ellie can kind of give them a little bit more dignity through the process. But that basic need for someone to be there for you and to have an ally in the process, I think, is similar to both groups. Ellie doesn't do a lot of that courtroom work that I told you about, just because we're now backing off of that, given some of the recent issues that have arisen across the country about using dogs in trials. So that is somewhat unusual in the sense that she was there for every step of the trial process for that victim.
Yeah, well, let's talk a little bit about that, because that was certainly something I found in sort of, you know, thinking about and gearing up to speak with you, that in particular there was a New York Times story, I guess, that really kind of sketched the controversy you know, using courthouse dogs and how the outcome in those cases where there's courthouse dogs used can be murky. And I think there was a specific case that they were citing with a dog named Rosie, who accompanied a teenage rape victim to the trial. The defendant was convicted and sentenced to 25 years to life. But the defendant's attorneys raised these objections, including arguing that as a so-called therapy dog, Rosie response to people under stress by comforting, whether the stress comes from confronting a guilty defendant or lying under oath or some other things. In other words, you know, it wasn't clear how Rosie's comforting someone that's on the stand. So is that kind of where this sits, and has that frozen in a way the use of courthouse dogs until this kind of case is resolved?
Right. That is where it sits. And I think the defense concern or argument is that the dog creates some kind of bias in favor of the testifying victim or witness, and therefore creates an unfair presumption of their truthfulness. So that case has not yet been decided. And since that case was appealed, I had a different case with a developmentally disabled man who was my victim, who testified with Ellie, and that case resulted in a conviction, and the defense on that case has also appealed Ellie's presence with that victim. So we have frozen our use of the dogs in trials and are just reserving are just using them now basically in interviews, in sentencing hearings, or in any other situations where there's not a jury there. So there's really plenty of uses for the dog outside of a trial situation.
Sure.
And it's really the vast majority of how, you know, of the ways in which we use them anyway. So it's not a big deal for us.
I see. And I'm just curious though, Paige, was the case that you had more specifically, was it appealed on pretty much identical grounds to the New York case we just discussed, or did they have a slightly different objection to the use of the courthouse dog?
It was pretty much identical grounds, I believe, and okay. They actually cited to the New York Times article in their brief.
So one of the things I was curious about, too, is, and again, all this, I guess, is sort of on hold while these cases are being decided, but I was curious because it seems like most of the things I've heard about and read about with the use of courthouse dogs is for, you know, the prosecution. But I have there been, at least before things were sort of put on hold, that, you know, instances where the defense attorneys kind of turned the table, as it were, and had a dog on the stand when a defendant would testify? Or, I mean, could that be done?
It could be done. I mean, it could certainly be done, and I haven't heard about that happening very much. The one exception to that is in juvenile court. And actually, used to be the chair of our juvenile division and had Ellie up there for a couple of years. And we used to use Ellie quite a bit for the juvenile defendants then, who were in as much need of her as the victims were in most cases. I used her a lot. We had a lot of competency hearings there where the competency of the juvenile respondent was at issue due to some kind of mental illness. And they had these kids had to sit there during these hearings and listen to testimony about their mental health and mental illness. And it was very difficult for them in many cases. And so I used Ellie for a lot of those hearings. And I'd give her to the kid, the defendant or the respondent, and let him sit there with her and pet her and just, again, in that same play that same role that she does for these victims that I talked about, where she just can give the kids some comfort and some sense of dignity in what's a pretty humiliating process.
Yeah.
So I think there's tremendous potential for using these dogs for defendants in juvenile situations especially.
So it sounds like, you know, even depending on how the cases that are sort of in appeal right now are resolved, and if it's ruled, hey, it did kind of skew the results, or we really therefore can't use, we can't risk maybe using courthouse dogs in these cases. It sounds like there's so many other great uses for Ellie and her counterparts that wouldn't necessarily be a huge setback.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's really, the trials are really probably the least frequent things that she does in the office.
And, you know, it's interesting though, back to that appeal just for one sec, because, I had kind of understood that the sort of nomenclature was vitally important when referring to courthouse dogs, and that courthouse dogs, or even just more generally service dogs, was kind of the preferred term, because I thought I read or heard that there were kind of problematic implications if they would be referred to as therapy dogs, just because of, again, how that might sort of prejudice the proceedings. And yet I found it really interesting in light of that, and maybe that was totally by design, that the defendant's attorneys in this New York case argued that as a therapy dog, this Rosie was responding a certain way that may or may not, you know, have affected the outcome of the case. So I guess, do you think they were just, you know, by design using that term? Because it seems like everybody else, from what I gathered, was trying to avoid with courthouse dogs using the term therapy dog, just because for some it might suggest, well, the person on the stand, you know, needs therapy or needs that kind of help.
Right. I think that's right. So I'm guessing that was by design, that they use that term in the appeal.
Yeah.
I think the other reason there's some resistance to using the term therapy dog is because it really, it's pretty easy for any dog to become licensed to be a therapy dog. You can take your pet to some training and get it licensed to be a therapy dog. And it kind of underplays the importance of having a really high-skilled dog for these courthouse kind of situations.
I see. Yeah.
You know, using your pet in these courtroom situations especially, I think, would be very dangerous, just because the dog has to be so impeccably well-behaved. And, you know, any kind of acting out would be very detrimental to a trial process. And
sure.
So they've got to be just very, very skilled, well-trained dogs. So I think that for that reason, too, it's good to call them facility dogs and then make it clear to people that they can't just be somebody's pet they're bringing in to be used in these situations.
And at the same time, Paige, when you're just now describing kind of how incredibly important it is, the skill and sort of behavior of Ellie and other courthouse dogs. I mean, it makes me wonder, given that and the kind of work that Ellie, you know, has been doing now for a number of years, I mean, what sort of toll, if any, does you know, because it seems like there's a high degree of sort of emotionally charged things and sort of, you know, very obviously upset and injured and damaged, you know, souls that Ellie is interacting with. Do you see that that's having an impact either cumulatively or in certain instances? Or
there are days when I see it. She has days where she's done several different interviews with different kids who've been talking about having been abused and have been upset and you know, have needed her comfort and her presence very strongly.
Mm-hmm.
I see that she, when we get home, she's clearly tired and I'll feed her and go for a walk as we usually do. And then, rather than hanging out with us in the living room and watching TV or reading, while we're doing those things, she will just get up and take herself to bed and go into the bedroom and lay on her bed and kind of cut out early. And that's pretty unusual for her to do. But on those days when she's worked hard and she's really been around people who have been in a lot of crisis or experiencing a lot of emotions, I see the toll it takes on her and her need to kind of not be handled anymore and not be interacted with.
Yeah.
So I do see it on that daily level.
Wow, interesting. Well, again, this is Talking Animals. My guest is Paige Ulrich, Senior Deputy Prosecuting Attorney in Seattle's King County, who works with and lives with a courthouse dog named Ellie. This conversation was recorded last Wednesday. So, well, with that in mind then, what is it like then when she's off duty? What are her days off like?
Well, she gets a number of days off, and I think that's why I don't see a whole lot of long-term toll that's been taken on her.
Yeah.
So she works usually 2 days, sometimes 3 days a week. And on the other days, she goes with our dog walker to a big piece of land with a bunch of dogs that are her pals, and she's off leash and running around and getting muddy and, you know, dirty and just having a blast for several hours. And then on the days that she does work, I take her, she goes to the park every night, and oftentimes we go for runs in the morning. And so she's got a lot of exercise built into her life.
Yeah.
And a lot of affection in her life. She also, you know, when she's not doing interviews, she's in our office, usually lying outside my office door in the middle of the hallway on her back, just waiting for people to come by and rub her belly. So she gets pretty much constant attention in the office, which is a really wonderful thing for her.
She's a dignitary. Come on by and pay your respects, right? Yeah.
That's right, exactly.
That's cool. But it also, too, it sounds like then, and especially on those other days, that she's, you know, really just doing dog things and having dog fun and having dog friends.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And she's quite a, you know, when her vest is off and when she's at home or at the dog park, she's a very normal seeming dog, but she definitely, you can tell a difference when her vest is on and she's working. It's really interesting.
Yeah. It's so interesting. Whatever the kind of work that a dog does, I mean, just when that thing is fastened on, I mean, the body language, the appearance, everything really noticeably changes. And it's just, again, it's a measure of, I guess, the really specific great training, but it's just, sometimes I'm still startled when I see that.
It's really true, and I think it also is indicative of how much they love to work. I mean, I really see her put the vest on. She gives me this little wag of her tail, and I just see that it's important to her to have this job, and I think it gives her a lot of pride in a way, and a sense of purpose, which is really cool.
Yeah, I've got a job to do, and strap this thing on, and I'm going to go do it. So that's
exactly.
Great. Well, Paige, thank you so much for making the time to join us on Talking Animals. I think it's a really interesting, cool way to incorporate dogs kind of further into our life. And again, it's great for those folks who are having trouble, you know, with interviews or at one point testifying. And obviously, from what you said, it's great for Ellie. And so, you know, everybody's a winner here, it sounds like.
I think it really is a wonderful thing.
Yeah. Well, Paige, thank you so much for joining us on Talking Animals, and give our best to Ellie.
I will do that. Thank you so much, Duncan.
Okay, thank you. All right. Our thanks again to Paige Ulrich, who made considerable effort to make herself available for that interview. She'll know what I mean. And we thank her. I'm Duncan Strauss. You're listening to Talking Animals. Well, the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to name that animal tune. As always, there'll be a prize, in this case a pair of tickets to see the Damien Jr. Gong Marley show November 17th at Janus Live. We're going to handle it a little differently since we're doing a Memorex version of Talking Animals. So rather than calling in, if you are the first person to correctly identify this animal tune via, if I may say via, email at talkinganimals@wmnf.org. Call in. Write in talkinganimals@wmnf.org with your emailed guess to name this animal tune. Just name that animal tune on Talking Animals.
There's a crow flying, talking ragged tree to tree. He's black as the highway that's leading me. Now he's diving down to pick up on something shiny. I feel like that black crow flying in a blue sky. I took the ferry to the highway, then I drove to a pontoon plane. I took the plane to a taxi, and a taxi to a...
All right. I think we gave you a lot to work with there. To be able to name that animal tune. So again, if you can, and if you're the first to write us at talkinganimals@wmnf.org, you will get yourself a pair of tickets to see Damien Jr. Gong Marley. That's tomorrow night, November 17th at Janus Live. I'm Duncan Strauss. This is Talking Animals. And we're going to hear, that's kind of a cool special treat. We're going to hear another animal song. This one from a band called Other Lives. A piece called Tamer Animals. I'm Talking Animals.
And it's all you see, and it's all.
right. Music from Other Lives. With a track called Tamer Animals. Getting us towards the end of today's edition of Talking Animals. In fact, we have just about reached the end. On WNF Tampa, we'll be back next Wednesday, November 23rd, when our guest will be Ellen Jaffe Jones, author of Eat Vegan on $4 a Day, a cookbook that certainly counters the contention that it's expensive to eat vegan. I also thought the day before Thanksgiving would make for an interesting and timely discussion about vegan cooking and eating. And Ellen, a local author, will be joining us in studio for that. So much to look forward to next Wednesday on Talking Animals, when we'll be back live, obviously. I hope you'll join us then. I also hope you'll visit our website, talkinganimals.net, where we make available all sorts of information, as well as archives and podcasts of past Talking Animals programs. We also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. That's all found at TalkingAnimals.net. Talking Animals broadcast outreach consultant is Libby McKenna. My thanks to her. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. Stay tuned for the fabulous Scott Elliott with the All Souls edition of It's the Music, airing next, noon to 3. We're closing out today's show, as always, with an animal tune. This one a little different for us. It's new music from Yo-Yo Ma, Stuart Duncan, Edgar Meyer, and Chris Thiele, with a piece entitled Goat Rodeo. Taking us right up to the NPR News, and then Scott Elliott and his great, great show right here on WNF Tampa. We'll be back with you next Wednesday, 11 a.m., for Talking Animals. Thanks so much for listening. Take care.